Now, on that score, Mark, I wanted to ask you a question based on a new book that's just been published. I just got a copy today. It's written by a man named Matthew Aid, A-I-D, and it's called The Secret Sentry,
right.
The Untold History of the National Security Agency.
Yeah.
And you told me you've already gotten a copy and read a good bit of it.
Yeah, I read it.
So I want to ask you this, because he cites a Washington Post article and also an interview with the El Paso Times given by Mike McConnell, who was the director of national intelligence at the time. And he said the number of NSA eavesdropping targets in the United States was 100 or less. Is there any way that could be true?
I think I pick up that issue in my book. It's a matter of how they define eavesdropping. They have the lawyers parse this out, you see.
Mm-hmm.
And the NSA has long said it's not eavesdropping until they actually make a transcription for human eyes to read.
So it's an intercept.
So if it's merely intercepted automatically by a computer and put in a data bank, it's not considered eavesdropping by them unless they go into the data bank and then say, give me all the emails of Mark Klein printed out so I can read them. Then it's eavesdropping. See, it's a lawyer's trick.
And in James Bamford's book, Shadow Factory, he interviews several of the people who were working for NSA who actually monitored these calls. They were the eavesdroppers.
Right.
And based on the implications, they don't talk about numbers specifically, but just based on the level of traffic and the details that they provided, it's flatly impossible to say that less than 100 Americans were eavesdropped upon in this country. That simply cannot be true.
Yeah, I think it's even more, certainly more than that, even if you don't count the ones that were just copied without being heard, because they have, like Bamford relates, they have these centers where experts sit down and listen to, Sybil Edmonds did some of that, right? You call it up, and you get all these channels, and they can just listen every day to the traffic going across, and if they find something is interesting, they can record it and listen to it later for further analysis. Certainly there's more than 100 just randomly doing that. They might be talking about ones that they... So you don't know how they define this, but it sounds like they're talking about ones that they are definitely tracking and have a FISA warrant for, right?
Mm-hmm.
So maybe there's only 100 of them on any given day. Who knows?
Well, but the FISA court raw numbers don't match that either.
I know, right. The point is they're always trying to minimize the scale and size of this thing. And I knew from what the physical apparatus they were doing that if you consider eavesdropping simply copying people's information, they were getting billions of messages every day of the year, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that doesn't square with 100 people, right?
Well, the other piece that we touched on earlier is data mining that started with the Pentagon's Total Information Awareness. And in this book, Mr. Aid talks about a White House that says the White House has refused to acknowledge NSA's parallel data mining program, codenamed Stellar Wind, which sifts through vast amounts of electronic data secretly provided by America's largest telecommunications companies and Internet service providers. And so with that data mining and with the massive intercept, the collection of telephone calls and emails, then that leads to the so-called eavesdropping, the actual monitoring of the intercepted communications. And again, the information we have about the scope of this does not square in any way, shape, or form with the minimal descriptions offered by people like Mike McConnell.
Yeah, there was another one I think I quoted in my book from the New York Times saying they only listened to 500 emails and phone calls at any one time or something like that. And that, too, didn't square with anything that I... and it was just, like I say, they're trying to minimize trying to make it sound innocent. That's why under Bush, they were trying to make it sound like they were only talking about people who call the Middle East. And everybody breathes a sigh of relief, thinking, well, I don't call the Middle East, so I don't need to worry about it, right? But that's clearly, they're clearly trying to mislead people as to the scale of this thing, because it's so huge.
And we're going to hear more about satellite intercepts at the end of this hour. I've had to trim some of these interviews slightly to fit them into the time, but as usual, the originals are available for download. And now we're going to hear from Kevin Zeese on the US government's use of infiltration to misdirect its political opponents. And thanks for this interview to Cheryl of 9/11 Wake Up Call. Now, this is from earlier this year.
I'm Cheryl. Today we're going to focus on COINTELPRO, or counterintelligence programs, which were, and definitely still are, the government infiltration of political movements. With me on the show today to discuss this topic is Kevin Zeese. He, along with Margaret Flowers, recently wrote two articles on the subject. One is called Infiltration to Disrupt, Divide, and Misdirect Are Widespread in Occupy. And the second one is called Occupy, Infiltration of Political Movements is the Norm, Not the Exception in the United States. Kevin Zeese is a lawyer and has worked on several political campaigns and even ran for the Senate from Maryland on the Green Party. He was one of the original organizers of Occupy Washington, D.C., October 2011, and is currently among the organizers of the National Occupation of Washington, D.C., which is about to begin on March 30th. Kevin Zeese, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me on.
You recently wrote some articles about COINTELPRO, or infiltration of political groups, and the title of one of those articles was Occupy, Infiltration of Political Movements is the Norm, Not the Exception in the United States. Could you expand on that?
Yeah, well, we're active in the Occupy movement, and as a result, we've seen some infiltration of encampments around the country by various types of officials, from law enforcement to right-wing groups to political operatives from the Democratic Party. You know, all sorts of people trying to either undermine, divide, or direct the Occupy movement. And so we started to research the history of infiltration in the United States as part of that, and a part of a three-part series that we're working on. And the history in the United States is pretty deep. You can go back 100 years and find infiltration of political movements, and it's rare in the last 100 years to see political movements that have not been infiltrated by the government. It really is the norm in American history, and I think in current politics, for groups to be infiltrated so the government's at least aware of what's going on. Once they get in and decide, you know, as for intelligence gathering purpose and decide to see what's going on, then they decide what they want to do about it. It could just be gather information. That's the least annoying type of infiltration, gathering information to see what's going on. But in the history of this kind of activity, there's been much more aggressive practices. They really try to direct where the organization's going, and they will even get up to assassination. There have been cases of infiltrators leading to assassination of political leaders, particularly the Black Panther Party in the late 1960s. And this is the biggest program is known as the COINTELPRO program. COINTELPRO is a program that looked at the civil rights movement, the peace movement, the women's rights movement, liberation movements around Cuba and American Indian movement, just all sorts. You really can't think of a movement that was not infiltrated. And it includes people like Albert Einstein and Martin Luther King, people who now have monuments on or near the mall.
You know, right.
And is so it's a pretty widespread practice.
Does the infiltration go across the political spectrum?
Yes. A lot of it has been on progressive groups, but there have been some infiltration of KKK-type groups and American Nazi groups. And so, yes, there has been some of that, but it's a very tiny percentage of resources. But I think that there's less of those groups in comparison to political movements on the other side.
And in one of your articles that you just recently wrote, I was reading that the ratio was one agent into every six demonstrators, and maybe you could talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, I was kind of shocked by that, but I shouldn't have been. There are two really good examples of this. 1968, the Democratic National Convention, there was an anti-war protest going on during the convention, and about 10 years later, documents came out that showed that one out of six of the 10,000 or so protesters who were out there were actually federal agents. In addition to those federal agents, there were probably also Chicago police. The Chicago had the Red Squad, as every city in the country had, over the last 75 or so years, red squads that initially were going after communists, but also were used to go after political events. So one out of six there. And the reason I shouldn't have been surprised is because I worked with Peter Camejo when he was running for office as a Green in California for governor, and also when he was Ralph Nader's vice president in 2004. I served as Ralph Nader's press secretary, so I knew Peter Camejo well. He often told the story about when he ran for president as a socialist in 1976, how there were break-ins into their offices, and they were able to get the FBI in court alleging Counterpro-type activities. And in court, the judge asked the special agent in charge, how many FBI agents do you have working in the Camejo campaign? And the answer was 66. Camejo estimated that he had about 400 campaign workers. That was one out of six of the people working in his campaign were FBI agents. And the judge ordered the FBI to leave within 30 days. Camejo then ordered that no one be fired, no one be allowed to quit, and no one be allowed to go on vacation over the next 30 days. And so he wanted to see who the agents were. Turned out one of them was the campaign co-chair. So these agents can get in not only in large numbers, but they get in deep. They become, my guy out of law school, my initial work was in ending the drug war, and I worked with a lot of police officials who used to be drug enforcement officials. And they described their job was, when they got in, was to make themselves indispensable, make themselves people who were relied on, people who did a lot of key work, so that when things happened, they were the go-to person and become the best friend of the leadership. And that's kind of what sounds like happened in the Camejo campaign. He got to be campaign co-chair of a presidential campaign who was actually an FBI agent.
Wow. Now, can these agents come from the military, local police, everywhere?
Well, it's interesting. You know, we looked at a number of specific cases, and we were very interested particularly in occupations because we were working in the Occupy movement. And so the most recent really large occupation in Washington, D.C. was just after Dr. King was killed. In May of 1968, there was a Resurrection City, which was an encampment on the Washington, D.C. Mall. And the FBI was heavily involved in infiltrating. They had not only people in the Resurrection City, but they also had people pretending to be press, coming to press conferences. They had people acting as just tourist types outside of Resurrection City, just around the area, just talking to people as they came and went. That was the largest area of infiltration. But the second largest area of infiltration of Resurrection City was the military. The military was aggressively involved in infiltrating Resurrection City, and they were using all sorts of high-tech devices to record and capture information going in and out that they would share with the six or so other police forces that were involved in monitoring Resurrection City. I know when we were in Washington, D.C. for Occupy Washington, D.C., I don't think we had the military, but certainly Homeland Security was involved in both working with us when we did protest, but I assume also monitoring our activities.
And I know there were a lot of homeless people in the Occupy movement that joined the Occupy in different cities and became sort of a problem for some of the groups. Do you think that they may have been sent there on purpose, or were they infiltrated?
Well, there were definitely reports of homeless folks being sent into the Occupy. Not only homeless folks, but also police in New York were reportedly sending some of the people they knew were problem people, mentally ill, criminal element types, into Zuccotti Park to cause trouble there. We had some homeless people working with us in Washington, D.C. Some were very good, by the way. So just like with any category of this, I think one of the most important rules of dealing with infiltration is, first, don't get paranoid and assume everybody's an infiltrator. And second, don't accuse people of being infiltrators. Instead, focus on what they do. And I'd say the same thing to the homeless community. We had some very good homeless activists in Freedom Plaza, and so this is not a broad brush comment on homeless folks. But there has been a tradition in many cities of using homeless to gather information about criminal activity. They're on the street. They see what's going on. They're usually in poorer neighborhoods where crime is more common because people are more desperate. And so they became informants generally in policing. And we suspect that there were definitely homeless people who were sent into the camps to disrupt. They would be at the General Assembly raising issues about where's the money, what was the money spent on, all this kind of just kind of causing disruptions. You know, where are the free Metro cards? It was a big fight in New York City, always at the General Assemblies, or not always, but often at the General Assemblies. So that does happen as well. So homeless folks are low cost. You could probably, a pack of cigarettes or $20 will be enough to get a night of disruption of a General Assembly.
Wow. So what are some of the other signs to look for? I know you said sometimes they'll get rowdy or try and disrupt the meetings. Are there other signs that people can look
for? Yeah, well, as I said, first, there are different kinds of infiltrators. And in fact, the final article we're going to be doing, we've done two parts so far. The first article talked about how widespread is infiltration in the Occupy movement. We did a survey of occupiers, talked to occupiers. We traveled along the West Coast to meeting with occupiers out there and getting a sense of how common this was. We found it was very common, by the way. Second article that I kind of talked about already is the history of infiltration. The third article is going to be about how to deal with it, and part of that is spotting infiltrators. And as I said, the most important thing is not really to look for the infiltrator, but look for actions. And the common actions would be to get in close. Some will go in quietly, become part of the community, become friends with people, become doing a certain function, just becoming a reliable member of the community. Then down the road, they can take actions of various sorts to direct where the community is going, what the community is considering, and relay information back to the police. So that's one aspect, is getting in close. Second, it's very common for infiltrators to want to get information like financial information. And they want to get this for a couple reasons. First, it's useful information for the opponents of the political movement, but also it's a useful way to cause divisions. Money is a great divider. What did that money get spent on? Where did that money come from? Who decided that money got spent? Why don't we spend the money on this? Why don't we spend the money on that? And you can cause all sorts of divisions by fighting over money. Another very common area of infiltration activity is getting involved in the media, so they can become the person who communicates to the media about the message and thereby give out the message they want to give out rather than what the Occupy wants to give out. And in these days, of course, that means not just talking to the press, which is a more challenging area for the infiltrator to get to, but can be done. But more common is taking over social media like Facebook pages or web pages or Twitter accounts, and then using those to direct. In Phoenix, for example, at the Occupy in Phoenix, they had a very open policy as far as allowing people to be administrators of their website. And one of the administrators erased all of the videos that were taken, live stream video library that they had stored on the website that was going to be used actually to defend people who were arrested, to show actually what happened in the arrest. All of that was erased. In Lancaster, Pennsylvania, somebody took control of their email network, made it into an announcement-only email, and when the occupiers were faced with a police action to close the camp, they put out a message saying that Lancaster occupiers decided to leave voluntarily and peaceably. In fact, there were 30 occupiers who were ready to stand and risk arrest, to force the police to arrest them if they were going to close the camp, and the General Assembly had not decided to leave without resistance, and of course, nonviolent resistance. And so getting that out to their network of occupiers and to the media was a way for this infiltrator to totally undermine and confuse, and as a result, there was no resistance to the police when they decided to close the camp.
Is this legal, this kind of infiltration by the military?
Some is and some isn't. Of course, you're in a public park, and so anyone can be in a public park, and so that's one aspect of it. But there are definitely parts that are not legal. It's certainly not legal for the military to be involved in this kind of activity, and that was not even legal when it was happening in Resurrection City back in those days. And it's also not legal for infiltrators to be urging serious criminal activity. That's going way beyond as well. So there are clear violations there. And, of course, our constitutional rights have been so filled with holes. Congress shall make no law abridging freedom of speech or right to assemble to redress grievances. There are lots of laws that restrict our freedom of speech and our right to assembly. No searches without probable cause or search warrant, of course, that happens every day throughout the country constantly, to the point of pat-down searches regularly occurring by TSA officials and others. And so the Constitution makes these grand statements, but there's a lot of weaknesses in them and a lot of exceptions. And in fact, I think we've gotten to the point now where the exceptions are the rule on almost all these constitutional rights that we're supposed to have.
Yes, that's really very frightening. Now, I understand that you are one of the founders or original organizers of the Occupy Washington, D.C. back in October, and you're starting up another occupation starting, I think, March 30th?
That's right. We're starting, beginning March 30th, the National Occupation of Washington, D.C. It's going to go for the month of April. It's not going to be an ongoing occupation, but a one-month activity, and we will be having a wide range of activities. People can read the details at nowdc.org. And we're going to be covering things like we're going to be having a social forum, which is an educational event that brings occupiers together to talk about a wide range of issues, not just policy issues, what's the solution to healthcare, what's the solution to banking, but also, more importantly, I think, sharing experiences about what has worked, what hasn't worked, what kind of strategy makes sense to achieve our goals, what kind of tactics work with those strategies, how do we work with labor more effectively. There's been positive and negative experiences of working with labor on both sides, labor side and Occupy side. What do we learn from that? So building the movement with a lot of knowledge-based activities through occupiers sharing information. We'll have a full-day conference called Controlling the Corporation, which we'll be talking about with strategies and tactics to weaken corporate rule and take control of our lives. There'll be lots of actions. The first day we have an action called Occupy the EPA, which is on March 30th, and that's going to have speakers. It's going to have alpacas, a pack of alpacas, in fact, nationally award-winning alpacas. We're going to have a big blow-up earth and a polar bear puppet, and we're going to be calling for the EPA to enforce clean air laws and protect the environment rather than protect corporate interests who want to profit at the expense of the environment. And so that'll be an exciting day. Helen Caldicott, who's a long-term anti-nuclear activist, Ralph Nader will both be speaking, as will Marsha Coleman Adebayo, who is a EPA whistleblower, Margaret Flowers, who's a single-payer healthcare activist. So it's going to be a pretty interesting day of protecting the planet for a sustainable future. That's the first protest. There's other protests already planned. The first weekend, there'll be a Occupy Department of Education challenging the abuse of testing and how those tests are used to privatize and close down public schools. There'll be an Occupy Department of Justice action later in the month focused on mandatory sentencing and political prisoners and privatization of prisons. And there's a direct action working group that's developing a whole bunch of other actions as well. In the middle of the month, April 14th and 15th, we're going to have OccuFest, a celebration of Occupy power, both music and art and political speech and spoken word, talking about political issues that the Occupy is concerned about. And that's going to be a two-day event in Meridian Hill Park on 16th Street in Washington. So a lot going on. I really urge people to come down and participate. If they can come down for a weekend, come down for a week, come down for a few days, they should come to Washington and Naples and go from March 30th to the end of the month. And really, I think it's a real chance to uplift the Occupy movement to a new level of activity.
Wow, it sounds really great. What day is the Control the Corporation going to be?
Controlling the Corporations is on April 2nd. That's going to be the first major educational event that we'll be having, and it's going to be a full-day event going from 8:30 till 5. The details are on the Now DC website under the Educational Activities and the Social Forum, and it's got a great group of speakers who are participating, so it'll really be a great event.
Yeah. Now, I'm assuming that you're going to be infiltrated on this event, it sounds like.
We may already be. You know, we have about a 45-person or 40-person group that's meeting and involved in trying to organize this event. And you can't tell from these telephone calls who's who all the time. I don't know everybody for sure. And so I expect they probably already are infiltrators.
Wow. And so how do you deal with that? You just kind of go forward and look for signs? And
Well, you go forward and you start to put in protections. Like, for example, while everybody has the ability to post on our Facebook page, there's only a couple of administrators. While everybody has the ability to post on our website, there's only a few administrators there. Same thing with our Twitter account. And so you limit the access. And we discussed these kind of issues openly because there was one occupation that ended up not endorsing it, but they wanted to have every occupation should have two people with administrative privileges on the website. That would have been a disaster. And we decided that we didn't want to go that way. And so we decided not to give them that. And that, as a result, they didn't join the occupation. My suspicion is that that occupation has been heavily infiltrated and that they were being pushed that way by people who are manipulating them to think that they needed that kind of power as part of Occupy DC.
Wow. So this is a really effective technique that the government uses to...
They've perfected this over the years. This is not some, you know, hey, let's try this. This is something they've done as a tactic, a strategy with specific tactics under it for decades. They know what they're doing. They do it with intention. And we just have to expect it. As I said, you know, it's very important not to be paranoid about it. We don't want to get off track of our mission of building an independent movement that will challenge the corporate power and the structures that hold political power in place. That's our mission, and we're going to stay with that, and we're not going to get off track of that, and we're not going to be paranoid about this issue. We're going to put in place principles that deal with issues like people coming to a General Assembly and disrupting. We'll have principles that don't allow that, and so that can be dealt with when it occurs. We'll have principles against people gossiping and doing negative conversation about others rather than talking to them directly, because that's a very common divisive tactic. We're cautious about who can have total access to the administrative privileges on our social media, who can talk to the media, and what they can say. And so you have all these kinds of things in place, and you move forward and do your work. And so that's just part of the process of organizing in the freest country on earth.
Okay. Yeah, getting less free all the time. But now, do corporations have infiltrators going out, do you know?
Corporations have developed very professional security systems. I would very much expect that they would have this kind of activity going on. I was involved in a project called Stop the Chamber, which was focused on the Chamber of Commerce, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, which is about the biggest corporate bully in Washington, D.C. They do most of the dirty work of the corporations lobbying in D.C. They're really very aggressive at it. And we, thanks to Anonymous, we discovered that there was a plan by a private security firm, H.B. Gary, working with a big corporate law firm in Washington, D.C., who works for the Chamber of Commerce, Hunton and Williams, and they were planning a campaign against us. What happened was H.B. Gary made the mistake of attacking Anonymous and saying they were going to expose Anonymous's leaders, which is just absurd on its face since there are no leaders in Anonymous. But they were going to expose Anonymous leaders, and Anonymous attacked them instead and downloaded 70,000 emails of their CEO. And in those emails was a plan to go after critics of the Chamber of Commerce with a cybersecurity campaign that would have been an attack on with creating fake websites and fake website email personalities, sock puppets to give us false documents, undermine our credibility. By then we publish the false documents and we lose our credibility. Monitoring our children, you know, all sorts of stuff was being planned. And thankfully that got exposed before it was able to take root.
Now, is there anything that we can do to prevent this, that citizens can do to try and curb this or prevent it?
Well, I think it's most important for citizens not to be afraid of it. What we are all doing is legal, and the kinds of civil resistance activities that we engage in are minor, essentially going where we're not supposed to go, saying what we're not supposed to say, and refusing to leave when we're told to leave. That's pretty much the extent of our criminal activity. And so that's not anything very serious. And almost always you can do organizing without any violations of law at all. And we can even do things that we're going where we're not supposed to go and saying what I was supposed to say, and even then not being arrested. So I think it's very important for people not to be afraid of this. I think that they should be recognized that the best way to combat this is to get involved and to participate and show that the public is getting organized and mobilized. I think that really is what it's going to take to change the culture enough so that we can get the kinds of policies we want, policies that represent the interests of the people as opposed to the concentrated wealth that dominates the government right now. That's what we're fighting against. We're fighting against essentially an oligarchic system where the most wealthy people and most wealthy corporations in the country control government and write laws on their behalf. And you can see that in the tax structure. You can see that in so many different ways. And so people need to get organized, get educated, and get mobilized in order to take back the country and make it a country of by and for the people, not of by and for the wealthy.
I was just reading about a law that was passed recently by Congress and signed by the president that limits our ability to demonstrate or protest by saying that we couldn't stand so many feet near where there was an elected official who had Secret Service around them.
Yeah, that's a new law that essentially if the Secret Service is protecting somebody, that becomes an area where you can't protest, which we think is actually designed exactly for the Occupy. There have been some instances where presidential candidates and other political candidates were being mic-checked, essentially the audience start talking in unison about a position they hold of some kind, and that's the kind of thing that they like to forbid. But all it does is create essentially a trespass law, which is a minor misdemeanor, and it's not a gigantic criminal offense. So again, I would not let people be afraid. I think people need to see this as a reason to stand up. In fact, what I think it shows is the government's afraid of the people, and I think that means we're making progress. So I think that this people should stand up and feel confident and stand up in unison, and we do that in a mobilized way. I think that they can't stop us.
Right, I agree with you on that. And so Could you tell us your website again if people want to get involved
In
your D.C. event?
Well, I recommend two websites. Now D.C. is the National Occupation of Washington, D.C. It's nowdc.org. And if you want to get kind of updates on what's happening in the Occupy movement, particularly from a D.C. perspective, OccupyWashingtonDC.org covers that activity. And so I think those sites will get you pretty involved in what's going on the Occupy movement. If you're just interested in economic issues and the unfair economy, our economic website is It's Our Economy, and that's itsoureconomy.us.
Oh, I'll have to check that one out. I didn't know about that.
Yeah, we cover all sorts of economic issues there. And one thing you might find interesting in it is on the anniversary of the Powell memo, we published that memo. It was a 1971 memo by Lewis Powell, who at the time was a tobacco lawyer in Richmond but active with the Chamber of Commerce. And this is the time when the Weathermen were bombing banks, and Ralph Nader was young, and the Black Panthers were, and the Civil Rights Movement, and the Peace Movement, and the Women's Rights Movement were all kind of taking power and really building up a great deal of momentum. And Lewis Powell wrote a memo to the U.S. Chamber of Commerce laying out a plan for how corporations could take back the government and take control. And it not only talked about the courts and elected officials, but also talked about taking over control of universities, taking control of journals, the media, anything that kind of shaped power. And he laid out a plan. And it's been that plan over the last 40 years that's been instituted, that has been put in place in order to take corporate power and the stranglehold we're stuck in. So if you go to It's Our Economy, look up Powell Memo, you can read about that. And then on OccupyWashingtonDC.org, we have also a discussion of the Powell Memo. If you search Powell Memo there, you'll find an article by Bill Moyers of Bill Moyers Journal on public TV. And he talks about what happened after the Powell Memo was written, how the corporate powers began to mobilize to put it in place, and the kind of meetings they held with AT&T and CBS and ABC and General Electric and other big corporations to plan to implement the Powell Memo. And then it went on to grow. The Chamber of Commerce doubled in size, go from 75 or so corporate lobbyists to 18,000 corporate lobbyists in Washington, D.C. today to really build an infrastructure of corporate power with institutions like the Heritage Foundation, the Cato Institute, all that kind of stuff, to really control the direction the country's going. So this has been a long-term, 40-year plan put in place by corporate powers. Lewis Powell, by the way, 2 months after he wrote the memo, was nominated to the U.S. Supreme Court by Richard Nixon.
Wow. Sounds like a conspiracy to me.
Sounds like a plan.
It is a plan. I'm joking.
Certainly a plan.
Yes. Yes. Well, Kevin, I'm imagining you must be really busy with March 30th just around the corner.
That's right.
I really appreciate your taking the time to talk to me today. Thank you for being on the show.
Okay. Happy to do it.
And now we're going to return to the activities of the NSA, switching continents. Thank you to Chris for providing this recording of researcher Steve Schofield speaking about the report he's just been in charge of into the activities of RAF Menwith Hill. And I shall link in the report from this show's webpage. And the talk itself has a question and answer session that follows, and it's over an hour. And we've got time for less than half of that. This is from early this week.
Very, very pleased to welcome Dr. Steve Schofield, who has just done this report on Menwith Hill. It's already been launched in Leeds,
Harrogate.
And this is our Sheffield launch. I think quite a lot of the people here have been. Have you been to Menwith?
Yes.
So we've all been to Menwith, I think. All of us haven't been there sometime, so we're sort of familiar with the place from the outside.
Great.
So, but thank you very much. It's good to have you.
Well, thank you. Thank you for the invitation. I was just thinking it's about 2 or 3 years ago since I last came to Sheffield for a presentation. I was working for the Campaign Against the Arms Trade, and we did a report on control of the arms trade. And as I remember, it was quite a feisty meeting, actually, so we've got a reputation to live up to tonight. So, what I want to do, I don't want to spend more than half an hour really talking, but basically what I want to do is just give you the background to the reason why we started the research. And then there's a slide presentation that goes through the report, or some of the main elements of the report. And I'm assuming that people have a general background information. If you've been to the base, you'll know what it looks like, but not necessarily any more detailed information about what its functions are and how it actually operates as a spy base. So we'll go through that, and then we'll go through some of the investment that's been taking place in the last few years, and then we'll look at the economic case that the US authorities make about the base, which is the reason why we started the research in the first place, because they claim that the base puts hundreds of millions of pounds into the local economy, effectively. And we were very wary about some of the figures that were being produced. So we wanted to test those and challenge them. And that was the original reason why we put in the research, funding the bid. But as we got into the research, it was obvious that you couldn't separate the economic arguments from the strategic function of the base, because it functions essentially as a secret US spy base, determining the nature of the relationship between the base and the local community. So that was really how the report came together. And I should also acknowledge the work of other people in this as well. I take responsibility as the author for the report, but it was very much a collective exercise. There were lots of people who were really energized about the project and gave, you know, mainly on a voluntary basis, incredible amounts of time to the project. I felt very humble at the end of it to think that, you know, the report reflected all sorts of concerns that people had and the commitment that the Yorkshire CND people had to trying to challenge the basic claims about its sort of benign strategic role and its contribution to the local economy. So that was, you know, probably the most cooperative, if you like, exercise I've ever been on, really, in terms of research. So that was good as well. Basically, you know, I've not got much affinity with computers, about the same affinity as George Osborne has with economics, I think. So I'm going to switch it on and we'll go through the slides and see how we get on, all right? But it could be the whole thing collapses, then I'll just have to rely on my natural wits, if you like. Here we go. Okay, so first deliberate mistake, I downloaded the wrong sort of heading, which is the original heading without editing it. So it says Muirth Hill there, which is obviously wrong. But it's lifting the lid on Muirth Hill, which is the title of the report. The strategic roles and economic impact of the US spy base in North Yorkshire. So those are the two main elements that we were interested in. To start with, I just wanted to go briefly through the history, if you like. Muirth Hill is a signals intelligence electronic spy base run by the National Security Agency of the United States. That's the first point to make. It's not an RAF base. It's run by the biggest spy organisation in the world, the NSA. It has its headquarters at Fort Meade in Maryland, about 20 miles from Washington, D.C. And Muirth Hill is part of a network of ground stations around the world to provide the United States with a global system for the interception of electronic communications and its analysis for intelligence purposes. Okay, so that's essentially what Muirth Hill is. You know, you have a public relations, if you like, curtain at the front door, which is that it's an RAF base. And that's obviously from the point of view of the Ministry of Defence and the United States Department of Defence perspective, important to try and project this as a equal and reciprocal relationship between the UK and the United States, but it's not. This is a base that's dominated by the United States for United States purposes. It runs a global network of interception. And all that information is channeled directly into Fort Meade near Washington for the purposes of United States military force projection. Now, how does it do it? Well, we've all seen the radomes. We all know why they're there, more or less. But I think it's worth just pointing out exactly what the technical perspective is from the point of view of the United States. These giant receiver dishes intercept microwave signals directly transmitted from commercial satellites and those captured by the US fleet of satellites in geostationary orbit that intercept the signals that leak out into space. So there's two ways in which this NSA network actually intercepts communications from satellites. One is directly from the links that the commercial satellites make with their ground receivers on Earth. And the other is a lot of microwave signals sort of disperse into space, they leak out into space beyond the commercial satellites. So there's a whole fleet in geostationary orbit around the planet that the United States picks up. And then the key thing is that Muirth Hill is one of the regional centres that's used to download those signals from the spy satellites. So again, that's basically the way that these operate in terms of intelligence gathering. And the really important thing about Muirth Hill isn't just the radomes, but its operational capability as well. As it says there, there are teams of cryptanalysts, which is basically cipher code breakers, and linguists, and then technical specialists from some of the major arms corporations in the United States, like Lockheed Martin and Northrop Grumman and Raytheon, who provide the technical background. If you can imagine this sort of complex satellite communications and links to the information technology. And then you've got these massive banks of computers in the operations centre that try and analyse all this data flowing into Muirth Hill. And they look for keywords and signals and then analyse those more closely when they find a key signifier that they're interested in. and then they analyse that for intelligence purposes and send the intelligence back to Fort Meade as part of this global system. So it's a massive exercise in intelligence gathering. Okay, so there are four main functions at Menwitzville, and the report goes into them in a fair amount of detail. I'll just summarise them now, but essentially there's traditional signals intelligence, or SIGINT, which we've been talking about up to now, commercial espionage, space-based infrared system, and what I've called intelligence-led warfare in the report. Now, the traditional... yes, it is an oxymoron, but then, you know, I think there's a lot of terminology in the military that's oxymorons, but why not add another one, you know? Anyway, so the traditional way that they work in terms of signals intelligence, for example, in the Cold War, they would monitor the communications between the Soviet Union, USSR, and its Warsaw Pact allies, and try and work out, you know, troop deployments, tank deployments, those sorts of things from intercepted communications. It's a bit like what Bexley Park did in the Second World War. I'm sure people all remember the Enigma code breaking and how that helped win the war in terms of identifying the position movements of U-boats in the North Atlantic campaign. Well, it's a similar exercise, but, you know, a much more sophisticated level. And then in the two Iraq wars, what Menwith Hill would do would be monitor the electronic communications from Iraqi command and control centres and inform the military where those centres were prior to the invasion by bombing them and taking out some of their communications. So that would be Menwith Hill's role in traditional signals intelligence, if you like. Commercial espionage is another big one that tends not to be looked at very closely for Menwith Hill. And they won't talk about it, essentially because it's illegal, obviously, so they're not going to make a big song and dance about that. But it goes on to a quite sophisticated level. We know that from the work of whistleblowers and from the European Parliament's investigation in the late 1990s and early 2000s. So the first whistleblower, if you like, was a woman called Margaret Newsham, who worked for Lockheed in Menwith, and who's helped set up the original spying on commercial operations of European companies. And they would regularly intercept those communications on international contracts, for example, and send that information off to US-based companies for their commercial advantage. And the European investigation was called the Echelon investigation, because that was the name of the system. You know, every military spy sort of project has to have a really fancy, sexy name. This one was Echelon. There's other ones like Moonpenny, and the whole list is there if you want to go through the report. But this one was called Echelon. And it was written by Duncan Campbell. And if I had to recommend any report about Menwith Hill and the operation of the NSA in Europe, I'd recommend the reports that he did as part of the European Parliament Echelon investigation, because they're absolutely superb. Mm-hmm. At a technical level, they're superb, because they identify the value of the contracts that were lost. And it runs into billions and billions of dollars during that 1990s period, through to the actual technical data about how the NSA bases in Europe operated. Not just Menwith Hill, because there were other bases. Another one in Germany called Bad Aveling, which did more or less the same thing as Menwith Hill, but from a German base in Bavaria. The report goes into detail about how commercial espionage operates for Menwith Hill. Now, they would deny it, and they have denied it in the report that was published about the presentation and the launch in Harrogate. The local paper has already got a comment back from the business saying they've never been involved in commercial spying. But that's completely contradicted by official European Parliament reports. You know, if you go back to the European Parliament for 2001, the whole Parliament endorsed the report. There was a vote of the whole European Parliament. It was a massive, overwhelming vote saying that what Menwith Hill and Bad Aveling was doing was illegal. And it was possibly challenging the basis of the European Human Rights Convention in terms of the privacy of individuals as well as companies. So that was a really important exercise in democratic accountability. Now, of course, that corresponded with the events of 9/11, And the report simply disappeared in the whole changing strategic environment that resulted in, you know, after 9/11, really. It disappeared off the agenda. But I'm absolutely convinced that for the last 10 years, although there's been no investigation of commercial espionage, it's ongoing because the Americans see their main corporations like Lockheed and Northrop as part of their security system. You know, they're absolutely vital in terms of providing weaponry. And if they're successful on an international basis, it reinforces their capacity to produce for the domestic industry, for the domestic procurement of the United States. And that's a key issue for the United States. So why wouldn't it use commercial espionage? I mean, that's the obvious question. Why not? When you're in a position to do it, which they are, and it's to their strategic advantage, what possible reason could they have for not doing it? So the denial is obviously there because it is illegal, you know, under all sorts of international conventions about international communications. And I could give you some other examples, like Elizabeth Gunn, who's a worker at GCHQ. She was a GCHQ operative in the run-up to the invasion of Iraq in 2003. And she was asked by a senior NSA official in an email to help spy on the members of the Security Council. Again, illegal tapping of diplomatic communications, because they wanted a second resolution to support the war against Iraq. And she was so appalled by this, about the contrast between the official line, which was to say that they were still looking towards diplomatic negotiations with Iraq, and at the same time they were obviously preparing and committed to war and trying to pull every stop, including illegal interception of diplomatic communications, to pressurise the Security Council for a second resolution. So that's the sort of level that Menwithel operates on, you know. And we shouldn't pull any punches about that. You know, it's a US spy base, it's involved in illegal activities, and we should be clear about the scale of those illegal activities.
The changing ways that people communicate with each other at the moment, you know, from telephone to computer to computer.
Yeah.
Has that made any difference?
Or yeah.
Are they still able to do the same?
Well, there's all sorts of levels at which this operates, because partly there's been, well, obviously an increase in cable communication, so landline optic fibers. Fiber optics, which they've accessed through Menwithel as well. And then there are a set of choke points where the fiber optic communications are interconnected with the satellite communications, especially in the United States. So they've got access to those, if you like, choke points, because they have a deal with the main internet providers that they have to have access. The NSA has access to all this information sources. We've been building a vast sort of database collection center in Utah, precisely for that, so that we can have data storage of all that material. And it runs into, I mean, I'm not a computer expert, but it runs into billions and billions and billions of bits of information that are flowing through these centers.
Those are the sort of first two. Now,
again, space-based infrared system is essentially part of the anti-ballistic missile system. So I'm sure people know about Star Wars. You know, Reagan's vision of a comprehensive ballistic missile system has still been around for a long time, and it's been reinvigorated under Bush. And I'm afraid it's been maintained under Obama as well. Now, I won't go into the whole system, but it's basically there's a whole range of systems that have been put in place. Some of them are missiles, and some of them are satellite sort of protection and identification systems. And Menwithel's role is in that, really. The space-based infrared system is essentially satellites that can identify the early stages of a missile launch and the trajectory of the launch. So the satellite communicates that information to Menwithel, should the launch be taking place. And then Menwithel will transfer that information to Fort Meade and to the General Communication Center for all the anti-ballistic missile operations in the United States. So, theoretically, they can start launching missiles. anti-ballistic missiles to bring down those missiles using the information from Menwith Hill. And that's a very big project. It's last estimate is about $17 billion for this space-based infrared system. And Menwith Hill is an integral part of that. So it's really intimately involved in the militarization of space as well. And it's very destabilizing. If you think about it, I mean, it's not surprising that countries like Russia are saying, well, if you try and create an active ballistic missile system, we'll increase the number of missiles that we've got to try and stop you from having what they would see as a first strike capability. So it's really dangerous in terms of an escalation of another sort of arms race, if you like. And then there's the last one, which is, for me, the most interesting and the least understood at present. When I started this research, I had a pretty good idea of what was going on at Menwith Hill in terms of the first three elements. But I had really no appreciation of the scale of the investment that's been taking place in Menwith Hill to ensure that it could carry out its fourth main function, which I called intelligence-led warfare. And basically what that means is that there's been a multi-billion dollar investment to ensure that Menwith Hill can play its key role in supporting new forms of American warfare. And here we're talking about things like special operations forces and increasing the use of drones, remotely controlled weapons that require an intelligence element to them in order to be able to operate effectively. And by that I mean that what the new investment allows the United States forces to do is use a combination of satellite imagery and electronic interceptions to create real-time intelligence about what's going on the ground. Real-time in the sense that they can launch a drone very quickly with that information to virtually anywhere in the world and ensure that they've got the intelligence backup to identify the target at very, very close proximity. Now that's, to me, is a new capability that we've never been aware of in Menwith Hill before. And it's partly to do with how the United States wants to project power. You know, Obama doesn't want any more of these grandiose land wars that Bush embarked on. What he's tending to do now is to have special operations forces in a growing number of countries that are carrying out those sorts of operations. But in order for them to do it, they have to have this sort of intelligence backup that Menwith Hill provides. We're really concerned about that, because essentially what that means is the United Kingdom is providing a base on its territory for acts of war, and effectively, you know, forms of warfare over which we've had no accountability, over which we've had no debate in Parliament, and we're expected to accept it purely and simply on the basis that the United States can rely on the United Kingdom to cover this with the smokescreen of national security. And that's exactly what they're doing. They're saying, well, we can't talk about this because it's national security. Well, you know, we're saying we have to talk about it. We have to talk about it fairly quickly because it's becoming, well, I think for a lot of people, a serious issue about the Western approach to the military, basically, and a military operation. Okay, now we're going to change tack now. I mean, there's a lot of information there. I appreciate that. And I don't want to pour any more onto you because there's plenty of stuff in the report that you can look at and hopefully sort of ingest, if you like, or digest, whatever. So we're going to go on to the economic arguments. The argument that the base makes is that it's a substantial contributor to the local economy. And it's one of the arguments that you hear very often in the arms industry and the arms sector is that we provide jobs and security to the local people, without which there'd be usually, you know, major economic disruption is the argument. We wanted to test that, so we were looking at some of the figures. The original figure that isn't on there is from 2009, which was that the base was worth £130 million to the local economy. So we asked a few questions about that, and it was a very difficult process to get any answers. That's one of the interesting things about this, is that they were quite happy to give an overall aggregate figure. But when we asked them to say how they calculated it, they were less forthcoming to people like me. And we were given the categories after lots of to and fro, but we weren't given the figures. And it was only when we asked the parliamentary question that we actually got the figures. And what that figure for 2010, which is obviously the height of the contribution, if you like,
of 163 million shows is that over 50% of that is based on US salaries. Well, there's an obvious problem with that. First of all, that a substantial proportion of those salaries won't be spent at all in the UK. They'll be saved and sent back home to the United States. So there's a whole category that should be taken out of there. And then the other major issue is that the base is run as a US economic enclave. I mean, this is a really important point that needs to be stressed, is that they bring supplies in from the United States, either fly them in or ship them in, into shops and supermarkets and cafes that are run on a dollar economy. They're run as dollar economy. They have no connection at all with the local economy. And it's a major disincentive for the US personnel who work there to actually spend money in the local economy, because it's subsidized. It's basically there on a cost base. So again, you'd have to calculate the figure for that and take that out of the money that goes into the local economy. And the other big issue is the construction element, which is again £32 million, and they were arguing that's local. And again, we asked some parliamentary questions, and we got a list of all the contractors who were paid more than £50,000 through the Ministry of Defence on the big project, which is the Phoenix project, the big building that houses all these supercomputers. And it was clear that most of the contractors weren't local at all. They were national contractors who were part of the UK MOD's sort of central contract base, you know, which you would expect for a complex programme like that. But they were counting that into the amount of money that was being spent in the local economy. So the whole calculation is completely, fundamentally flawed. And it's only now that, having had the opportunity to look at the figures, that we could make that case. And we sort of suggested that even allowing for a multiplier effect, which is the indirect contribution once the original money's been spent, and people spend in the local economy as a result of that, it's probably more like 50% of the figure that's on there. So, but we haven't had access to the data, so we can't say for certain how accurate that is. But what we've argued is there should be a proper economic impact assessment, and there isn't. Drag this out, but basically, the other side of the coin, which you never advertise, is the hidden cost to the UK of running US bases. Now, we asked some parliamentary questions and some freedom of information requests as well. And it emerged out of that that the Ministry of Defence has to pay for a lot of the infrastructure costs that go into the base, like electricity and the roadworks and the cabling. And that came to about £7 million minimum over 6 years. Now, they would never acknowledge that in public, but that's the way it is. We found that out from the freedom of information request. And in a roundabout way as well, either through freedom of information requests or using other sites, we've identified all these other costs, which are never included in the cost-benefit analysis for US bases in the UK, including indirect taxes, customs and excise and VAT. None of that applies on the base. All the goods that are flown in, consumer goods and various other items that are flown in, the Americans don't pay customs and excise or VAT on them. The base doesn't pay any business rate council tax. The interesting thing here, in terms of personal income tax as well, nobody pays income tax, none of the US personnel. That includes the private sector contractors from companies like Lockheed Martin. Now, these are some of the richest and most profitable arms corporations in the world. And these guys will be on six-figure salaries in some cases, and they pay no personal tax and they pay no council tax. There's also policing costs to North Yorkshire Police Authority. We estimate a minimum of £500,000 a year because their armed police are patrolled continuously around the base. Not inside, but around the base. And that's at a time when North Yorkshire Police budget is being cut. And then there's the ultimate thing is when the base is closed, there's going to be environmental cleanup costs, and those all accrue to the Ministry of Defence and to local authority.
And that's where we're going to have to leave this due to lack of time. The full speech is available for download from our webpage, unwelcomeguest.net/596, This and all previous episodes are available for download from unwelcomeguests.net/archive. Our theme music is by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Thank you for listening.